Good morning. It's 11 minutes before the hour. You're listening to NPR's Morning Edition over Raven Radio, KCAW in Sitka, where it's 40 degrees and overcast. Today is Friday, December 9th, 2011. I'm Robert Woolsey with Raven News. A hearing looking into the cause of a July 2010 helicopter crash moves into the third and possibly final day today. Coast Guard Lieutenant Lance Leone is being charged with dereliction of duty, destruction of government property, and negligently causing the deaths of two of his crewmates, aviation maintenance technician Adam Hoke and Brett Banks. An Article 32 hearing, a military version of a grand jury proceeding, has revealed more details about how the H-60 crashed off La Push, Washington. Matt Miller from KTOO has this report.
The second day Thursday included more testimony from lead crash investigator Captain Timothy Heisch. He was asked to draw the power lines that the helicopter hit when it crashed. They span 1,900 feet from a height of 36 feet on the mainland to 190 feet on James Island. The lines were used by the Coast Guard to power their own nearby marine aids to navigation. Heisch drew aviation hazard marker balls at the far lower end of the wire spans, suggesting that they had already slid down nearly out of sight of any nearby aircraft. Counsel for the government repeatedly pointed out that at the highest point, the power lines were still 10 feet lower than Federal Aviation Administration guidelines for marking or lighting hazards. Leone's counsel asserted that those very same lines were the subject of a lawsuit over whether they contributed to another pilot's death decades ago. Testimony also touched on the sectionals, or visual flight rules navigation maps used by aviators. Heisch, investigating officer Captain Andrew Norris, and counsels for both sides had both the Canadian and American maps of La Push opened up on the witness stand, trying to determine if markings for the power lines were accurate. "Where is James Island on this map?" asked Norris. "I think it's this small dot," was one response. After Heisch's testimony, Bosun's mate Second Class Kenneth Compton testified that on the day of the crash, an H-60 turned toward his 47-foot motor lifeboat and passed 100 feet overhead before heading into the wires. Then Leone's defense brought in his commanding officer, intended to counter Heisch, the government's own primary witness. Commander Doug Cameron of Air Station Sitka described how it made sense for Leone and Lieutenant Sean Kruger to do the ferry flight, take down an H-60J model to Astoria, and return with a newer H-60T. Kruger was very familiar with the J and flying in Alaska, while Leone was more familiar with the T. The publicly stated top speed for an H-60 is about 183 knots, but Heisch stated on Wednesday that Kruger and Leone exceeded the normal maximum operational airspeed of 125 knots for most of their flight. "Go much higher than that without good reason for too long, and it's hard on the aircraft." Cameron acknowledged that the couplers, or a rudimentary autopilot, may have been set at 125, but it could have constantly varied between 119 and 133 knots simply because of aircraft performance and wind. And on the issue of flybys of a Coast Guard boat, Cameron says they're not unusual. They're actually traditional, like a friendly waggling of wings to a buddy or a service mate. Cameron also says flying through wildlife refuges at low altitude in Alaska is not only common, it's sometimes necessary, whether to repair an aid to navigation or use a low-level route to escape poor weather and dropping visibility. Cameron also referred to the accident board's findings about non-standard lingo and radio communications as nitpicking and suggested that a non-verbal acknowledgement of a checklist completion was possible. Cameron also said he spent 2 hours on a recent flight himself troubleshooting a radio, which is more than Leone had done on his flight. Part of the government's case involving neglect is the allegation that Leone did not fulfill some of his duties as a co-pilot, essentially not questioning the pilot Kruger for his decisions and maneuvers. But Cameron, an experienced H-60 pilot himself, suggested that a more complicated crew dynamic may have been at play in the cockpit that day. First, Leone and Kruger apparently went to the academy together, with Kruger 2 years ahead. Also, Leone had just arrived in Sitka from Elizabeth City, North Carolina, where they did things differently flew much higher along the shoreline, for example. He was now brand new in a challenging environment where low-level flying was sometimes necessary, while his mentor, Kruger, already had a strong, solid reputation as a good Alaska pilot. Cameron called it a perfect setup for excessive professional courtesy. The junior officer was still learning and may have yielded to the senior officer's experience on that flight. At the same time, yanking the controls away from a fellow pilot is almost never done. The highlight of Cameron's testimony came, though, when he described getting a copy of the accident report and was asked whether he preferred charges against Leone. He ultimately decided against it, but Rear Admiral Thomas Ostebo, the new commander of the 17th District in Alaska, apparently didn't like that. Ostebo told his subordinate that he was too close to Leone and had lost his objectivity. According to Cameron's view of one encounter, it was a, quote, classic discussion with the high-intensity Ostebo. Cameron was asked to type up his reasons for the commandant of the Coast Guard, who was expected to visit Alaska shortly. Then, this past September, Leone's orders to train and requalify for the H-60 were canceled. He was charged in connection with the crash by another officer in district command. At least a half a day of testimony expected on Friday, possibly with more explanation of the 200-foot minimum for marking aviation hazards, and then the investigating officer, Captain Andrew Norris, will consider the testimony and evidence before submitting his recommendations to Rear Admiral Thomas Ostebo. Reporting in Juneau, I'm Matt Miller.
The Southeast Alaska Regional Health Consortium, or SERCH, has a new president and CEO. Charles Clement will replace Roald Helgeson as the head of the nonprofit Tribal Health Consortium in February. Helgeson is leaving at the end of the month to take a job with the Alaska Native Tribal Health Consortium in Anchorage. That's sort of where Clement comes from. He's currently vice president of operations and chief operating officer for the South Central Foundation in Anchorage. The group jointly owns and manages the Alaska Native Medical Center and the Alaska Native Tribal Health Consortium. Clement is an Alaska Native with Tsimshian and Athabascan heritage. He graduated from Metlakatla High School, did his undergrad work in economics and political science at Northern Arizona University, and holds a Master of Public Administration degree from the University of Alaska Anchorage. As president and CEO of SERCH, he'll be based in Juneau, but will oversee the entire consortium, which includes Mount Edgecombe Hospital in Sitka. Sitka residents have an opportunity to avoid one of the eternal pitfalls of our rainy, damp, cold winters. Healthcare providers in town are partnering up to offer a citywide flu vaccine clinic on Saturday at the Fire Hall. As diseases go, the flu is not very fun.
People say, "I feel like I was hit by a truck."
Kathy Ngalanera is a nurse practitioner at SERCH. She says people who ride out routine winter colds are getting off easy compared to those who get the flu.
They often have shaking chills, high fever, total fatigue, I can't move. They usually don't have a runny nose, but they often have a cough. With a flu, you're really feeling like you need to just stay in bed and maybe stay there the rest of your life.
And Galanera says Saturday's clinic can accommodate up to 300 residents age 6 months and older. A live virus nasal vaccine is available for healthy people under the age of 50 and traditional shots for everyone else. There will also be some doses of a new intradermal vaccine, which Ngalanera says is a boon for anyone afraid of needles.
It's given in the upper arm, but it isn't as big of a needle. It doesn't go into the muscle. It's actually a prefilled syringe, and it shoots out just, it's like 2 millimeters, and then it retracts, so it goes into the intradermal area of the arm and deposits the vaccine there, and it's just as effective as the IM.
Contrary to myth, Ngalanera says you can't get the flu from getting either shot. The virus is dead and triggers an immune response that may result in some mild symptoms for a while. Most people who come down with the flu after being immunized caught it beforehand.
Now, if you were at church on Sunday and hugged somebody and shook their hands and then come on Saturday and get your flu shot and you picked up the flu at church last Sunday or Wednesday at the grocery store, you're going to get the flu.
And Galanera also has this word of caution. While getting the flu can be unpleasant for most people, it can be dangerous for some, particularly the elderly, the very young, and patients with chronic illnesses such as asthma and heart disease. Clinic hours this Saturday at the Fire Hall are 10 a.m. to 2 p.m. The agencies participating include SEARCH, the Coast Guard, Sitka Community Hospital, the State Department of Public Health, and private practitioners. $500,000 is on its way to Yakutat from Washington, D.C. The Yakutat School District is the recipient of a distance learning grant from the U.S. Department of Agriculture's Rural Development Agency. School Superintendent Ron Schmug says the money will be used to purchase Apple iPads and computer servers that will help the district offer more distance learning courses. Yakutat, like a lot of rural school districts, faces declining enrollment. It has about 105 students right now. Schug worries about decreasing opportunity for students as their numbers decrease. But he says the $499,000 from the federal government should help change some of that.
It's a huge deal for us because the bottom line, Ed, with decline enrollment and everything else, there's no way that we could fund this out of our general fund.
The district's annual general fund budget is around $2 million. The money in this grant isn't all for Yakutat. Although Shug's district is the lead name on the grant, the money will fund programs in Chivac, Skagway, and the Denai Borough School Districts. School districts in Washington State will also partner with Yakutat to use the money. Ultimately, the grant will help offer everything from advanced placement courses and core subject areas to vocational programs like culinary education or health care.
You know, we're going to move quickly, but we're also going to put together a very highly structured academic program within that foundation. So that is one of our main goals there.
Shug says Yakutat had help from a Texas-based grant writer named Donna Gunn in winning the award. The $500,000 grant is part of a $2.3 million pool of money awarded across the state of Alaska. Zone weather forecast today for Sitka and Port Alexander calls for rain diminishing in the afternoon. Highs around 43, south winds 15 to 25 miles per hour decreasing in the afternoon. This is Raven Radio, KCAW, in Sitka.